Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, March 28th, 2018. We start with the news section. Get out! Just because you own your mobile home doesn't mean you won't get evicted, as a low-income Hispanic community in Siler City recently discovered. In the 6 years since Ann Huezo's mother gave her a mobile home in Siler City, in the hopes that Huezo, her husband, and their four kids would have a place to call home, they have made it their own. The kitchen walls are painted bright turquoise, refreshing even on a rainy Wednesday morning, and covered with family portraits. They've added a bedroom for their two youngest, painted lilac, and a small living room. We had initially thought we'd be here for a long time, said Huezo, but they won't be. Huezo and her family are among more than 100 people being forced to leave Johnson's Mobile Home Park after the park's owner sold the land to Montaire Farms, which is reviving a shuttered poultry processing plant next door. Residents have known since November that they have to leave, but they banded together to push back their eviction date and demand compensation for the homes they'll lose. It's a lease. The multi-billion-dollar corporation, which received millions in local tax incentives, can call itself Jesus-centered. Can do, they said. As they negotiated with Montaire Farms, they also asked local officials for help. Last week, the Chatham County Board of Commissioners pledged to assist them, but the form that assistance will take is still in the works. On Monday, after 2 months of negotiations, Montaire Farms agreed not to collect rent from residents and to give each household $8,300, provided they move out by July 31st. That's better than what Montaire originally offered, but it's still that's going to leave many of these families in the lurch. This sort of upheaval would be tough for any family trying to find affordable housing in the Triangle, but these residents' situation is unique. While many own their homes, they don't own the land underneath them, which means they either have to spend thousands of dollars to move their houses to another mobile home park or abandon them and lose their investment. For most at Johnson's Mobile Home Park, the former isn't an option. Their housings are too old to be moved. Huezo has better options than others. She has relatives in the area willing to take her and her family in. Still, her 8-year-old daughter has been crying in school, and her son, who normally gets excellent grades recently, got in a fight. The situation makes her sad, she says, but that word doesn't fully sum it up. I'm not sure how to explain the feelings I have, she said. Johnson's Mobile Home Park sits just off of U.S. 64 outside of Siler City in an area mostly populated by industry and auto shops. With 62 adult residents and 53 children, the park is home to just over 1% of the small town's population. Most are Hispanic, as are about 43% of the town's inhabitants. The park's 28 homes, most built in the 1970s and 80s, are set askew along dirt roads. The gray walls of the chicken plant show through bare trees lining the park's perimeter. The site used to be the Townsend Processing Facility, Siler City's largest employer, which shut down in 2011 after the company went bankrupt, taking with it 500 jobs. Montaire Farms bought the plant in 2016 and pledged to bring back hundreds of jobs. Siler City and County Cat officials agreed to give the company more than $2 million in incentives. The state also kicked in $1.5 million for wastewater improvements. The chicken plant property has been at the center of an ethics complaint against House Speaker Tim Moore, the vice president of Southland Land Holdings, LLC, which bought it for $85,000 after the Townsend plant closed and sold it to Montaire in 2016 for $550,000. In the meantime, according to the complaint filed earlier this month by the Campaign for Accountability, Moore delayed an assessment by the Department of Environmental Quality and persuaded DEQ not to engage in any enforcement action for violations of state environmental law, allowing him to reap significant financial gain. Moore has denied any wrongdoing. Last Monday, Chatham commissioners said they were unaware when they approved incentives from Monterre that a year later it would purchase Johnson's mobile home park and evict its residents. In fact, the previous owner, Jonathan Johnson, told tenants in a May 2017 letter that he had considered selling due to a drastic increase in cost to maintain and run the park, but decided against it. Instead, he wrote, he would be raising the $170 monthly rent to $210. A phone number listed for Johnson was disconnected. Johnson ended up selling the property to 1206 East 11th Street LLC. The LLC's address in Little Rock, Arkansas, is the address of a Monterre corporate office. Under pressure from residents, Monterre hasn't collected rent since it took over the mobile park in November. In order to achieve substantial capital investment and job-creating goals in Siler City and within the community of Chatham County, North Carolina, 1206 East 11th Street LLC provided a six-month notice to residents that leases in the mobile park that they would be extended beyond, they would not be extended beyond May 7th, 2018. Monterre Farms said that in a statement earlier this month. To evict an entire community from their homes, owners or renters, without any thought about the social implication of that is not acceptable, says Alana Dubster, executive director of El Vinculo Hispano, or the Hispanic Liaison, a Siler City nonprofit founded to foster intercultural understanding and to empower Hispanics. Residents reached out to the organization last summer when they first heard of a potential sale. First, the group asked Monterre for $46,000 per household to relocate. Monterre offered $5,000. Negotiations stalled until Monday when an agreement for $8,300 was announced. That would be enough for residents to move their homes, but because many of the park's homes were built before the 1976 implementation of federal safety and construction standards, they either can't be moved or may be rejected by other parks. This is a problem that stretches beyond Siler City. As Charles Becker, a Duke economics professor who studies mobile home parks, points out, manufactured homes are an important segment of affordable housing, especially in the South. According to census data, nearly 18 million Americans live in manufactured housing. Across the country, mobile home parks, often relegated to the outskirts of town, are aging, Becker says, and new ones don't open that often. Local government tends to be hostile, even though this is housing for people of limited means. If you talk about affordable housing, it's hard to get more affordable than manufactured housing parks, he said. In areas attracting growth or industry, there's economic pressure to convert mobile home parks to more profitable uses. In neighboring Orange County, residents of two other mobile home parks being sold are facing eviction as well. Mobile home park tenants are kind of the third-party victims of this development. This from Jack Holzman, a senior attorney with the NT Justice Center's Consumer and Housing Project. It's not necessarily a malevolent situation. It's not ill-willed. It's a mobile park owner that is trying to get the best return for their land. But it often can be unfair for the tenants themselves because getting affordable housing is very difficult. Karina Hernandez and her family have called Siler City home for 12 years. All three of her children were born there. For the past 5 years, they've lived at Johnson's Mobile Home Park, where her husband has been fixing their home a little bit at a time. When we bought it, it was basically in ruins, she said. Many of her known neighbors has also made investments in their homes, spending an average of $11,000, according to El Vecino Hispano. Still, Hernandez says her home can't be moved because of his age, and her family is struggling to find another place as affordable as the $210 per month rent that they've been paying. She isn't sure whether they'll go next, if her kids will be able to stay in their school. Her story is typical of what Johnson's residents told Chatham County commissioners last week in a public hearing punctuated by sobs and standing ovations. They described the difficulty of finding affordable housing near Siler City, according to El Vecino Hispano. Residents' incomes range from $15,000 to $20,000 and said they suspect some landlords are inflating their prices, knowing they are desperate. Montaigne's elimination of these homes openly deepens the affordability crisis, Loebster told commissioners. Chatham County Board Chairwoman Diana Hales called it a dire situation and acknowledged the dearth of suitable affording housing around Siler City, where the Housing Authority can't even find homes that qualify for inspection for Section 8 vouchers. The housing is in the poor condition. Commissioners asked staff members to look into what the county can do to assist the families. They are limited by state law from giving money to individuals, but they can give money to a nonprofit like El Vecino Hispano. A high school student told commissioners she may have to change school districts and worries her honors credits won't transfer. A retiree said she and her sick husband have no income with which to start over if they lose the home they worked hard to purchase. A 10-year resident said he doesn't want to capitulate to Montaigne in front of his kids. We have to show them that they can't have their civil rights be walked all over because they're Hispanic, he said. It doesn't matter how big your rival can be, they can be defeated. In a statement, the company says it's pleased a resolution was reached and that it will work with residents to ensure the money is distributed efficiently. While Vecino Hispano applauded the Montaigne for listening to the family's concerns and, most of all, for doing the right thing for these families, the company's payout will hardly put a dent in its bottom line. Between forgiven lot rent and per-household compensation, Montaigne Farms is spending $285,320, about 0.01% of the $2 billion in revenue it amassed in 2015, according to Forbes, and less than half of 1% of the total capital investment planned for the processing plant. Per household, that's just over $10,000, or about as much as some families spent on houses they could ultimately lose. We're not talking about people that are trying to pull a quick one or make an extra buck, Commissioner Karen Howard said last week. We're talking about people who are begging for dignity, that are asking to walk away from this with their heads up and in a very difficult circumstance. Everyone in this county knows about the challenge of affordable housing, and to present these families with the option of homelessness because we can't come up with thousands of dollars more is beneath all of us. I have no doubt that the individuals that make up Montaigne are decent human beings, and I also have no doubt that they can do more. The next news article, The Lost Cause. Most people in North Carolina want Confederate monuments to stay put. They don't know their history. On a cloudless day in October 1909, North Carolina Governor William A. Kitchen addressed a crowd at a dedication of a granite and bronze Confederate monument in Granville County. Thousands took part in the day's festivities, which included a parade and music. As the crowd waited for the statue's unveiling, the rebel yell broke against the sky as a band struck the first inspiring notes of Dixie. This according to a contemporaneous account. Kitchen used the dedication to profess his belief in the supremacy of the white race. Quoted, We have seen the white man come in contact with the brown man of the tropics, and the brown man went down, he said. We have seen him knock at the gates of the yellow man in the east, and they opened at his will. We have seen him face the black man in his native African home, and the black man gave him the path. We have seen him press the red man, and the red man is disappearing from the face of the earth. You see what the whole country is beginning to recognize, that it is not the power of all the armies ever drilled or ever constituted, ever written, to make the white and black races equal. End quote. The statue, which cost $3,000 and was sponsored by the Granville Grays chapter of the United Daughters of the Confederacy, was one of dozens of Confederate monuments that popped up around North Carolina from about 1880 to 1920. A boom town for the Confederate monument construction in the state. Among the many statues built during that period were three that today sit on the grounds of the state capitol. The Confederate Women's Monument, the Confederate Soldiers Monument, and the Henry Lawson Wyatt Monument, a depiction of the first Confederate soldier to die in battle in the Civil War. For the past 6 months, those statues have been at the center of a much larger debate about the place of Confederate monuments in public spaces. That conversation has been awakened by deadly acts of violence committed under the banner of white supremacy, including the 2015 massacre at an African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina, and the infamous events in Charlottesville, Virginia last summer, when a rally led by a white nationalist in defense of a statue of Robert E. Lee led to the murder of an anti-racist activist. After Charlottesville, activists doubled down on the demands to remove statues, celebrating the Confederacy, and officials from big cities like Austin, Texas, to smaller towns like Gainesville, Florida, responded. In Baltimore, the city's Confederate statues were hauled off in the middle of the night. In North Carolina, calls to remove the state's 140-plus monuments did not fall on deaf ears, but neither were they met with Baltimore's decisiveness. Instead, the state has spent more than 6 months debating the issue, except in Durham, where demonstrators tore down a Confederate statue 2 days after Charlottesville. That's because there are legal issues at play. Even in liberal urban locales where most residents would like to see the monuments gone. In 2015, the Republican-controlled General Assembly passed a law preventing local officials from removing any statue from public property without sign-off from the North Carolina Historic Commission. The law means that a petition filed by Governor Cooper to relocate the three Confederate monuments to a historic battlefield in Johnston County will have to ultimately be approved by the 11-member commission. Last week, the commission held a public hearing on Cooper's request, which the vast majority of speakers opposed. Those speakers may well reflect the will of the state's population. Multiple polls released last fall showed that about 3/5 of North Carolina residents want to keep the Confederate monuments in place. Many of the people who vehemently opposed Cooper's plan at last week's hearing expressed concerns that removing or altering the monuments would constitute historical erasure. It's an argument commonly deployed in the debate over Confederate statues. If we move one statue, what's next? One speaker said. Taking down the monuments and flags hasn't improved life anywhere it's been done. Only three groups have been successful in taking down monuments: ISIS terrorists, Bolsheviks in 1917, and modern communists in America. More than anything, though, the comments reveal just how little their most ardent defenders know about the history of the monuments at the center of the debate, and the lies they are willing to tell themselves. Most of the monuments were not erected in the years immediately following the Civil War. Rather, the boom ticked off in the 1880s as southern states began enacting Jim Crow laws and continued through the 1920s, an era that saw a second coming of the Ku Klux Klan. Indeed, according to W. Fitzhugh Brundage, The William B. Umsted Professor of History at UNC Chapel Hill, North Carolina, erected fewer than 30 Confederate memorials between 1865 and 1890, but dedicated more than 130 over the next 50 years. From about 1940 to 1980, monument construction slowed down, but revved back up again in the 1990s. Surprisingly, there have been more monuments to the Confederacy put up since 1990 in North Carolina than at any other time since the 1930s. Today, the Southern Poverty Law Center estimates that there are more than 1,500 public symbols to the Confederacy throughout the nation, with the 4th highest number in North Carolina. The statues were built not just to celebrate the Confederate veterans of the war, but also to glorify the cause of the Confederacy, which, as Brundage notes, was an armed nation created to defend the institution of slavery. Indeed, Confederate leaders were forthright about their reasons for secession. Consider, for example, Mississippi's Declaration of Secession, quote, "Our position is thoroughly identified with the institution of slavery, the greatest material interest of the world," end quote. Monument supporters could be just as explicit. A Brundage explains many of the Confederacy's participants used the monuments as an opportunity to voice their commitment to white supremacy. "All we have to do," he says, "is to look at the dedication speeches that were given to the people who erected the monument and by public officials to see page after page of testimonials to the preservation of Anglo-Saxon civilization and that the Confederacy was a model, the archetype of what whites should do to defend Anglo-Saxons." Consider Kitchen's speech, or this excerpt from Julian Carr in 1913 at the unveiling of the Silent Sam statue in UNC Chapel Hill. Again, quote, "The present generation, I am persuaded, scarcely takes note of what the Confederate soldier meant to the welfare of the Anglo-Saxon race during the 4 years immediately succeeding the war, when the facts are that their courage and steadfast saved the very life of the Anglo-Saxon race in the South," end quote. Carr also boasted of horsewhipping a Negro wench until her skirts hung in shreds for the sin of insulting a white Southern lady. And yet, it is not uncommon to hear the narrative that the war between the states was really about states' rights and a rebellion against Northern tyranny, and as such, the statues are monuments to liberty. This belief is one of the more insidious accomplishments of the mythologizers of the Confederacy, Brundage argues. The idea that somehow the Confederacy was representative of little people who were going to be walked all over by bureaucratic tyranny has lingered on, and now it is a creed for a certain type of person, he says, and it's preposterous. The Confederate mythology provides a cliched kind of populist small government versus big government, liberty versus tyranny argument that can be wheeled out on a moment's notice on any issue. Perhaps those clinging to this revisionist tale do so because accepting the truthfulness means grappling with the unsavory realities of one's own history. Some people are ready to do that, which may signal a new willingness to take on the legacy of the Confederacy. At last week's hearing, for instance, one woman likened the monuments to a mask, whitewashing her ancestors' cowardice and inhumanity. For another, whose ancestor fought for the Confederacy, "That fight may have been my family's at the time, but they have all changed." For many people, too, the monuments signal a hostile and imposing expression of power. Winifred Richardson, whose grandfather, a slave, bought his freedom at age 13, says she feels sick every time she walks past the Capitol monuments, which she believes were put there to intimidate African Americans. If the polling is accurate, Richardson and a handful of others who voiced support for moving the monuments don't speak for most Tar Heels. But it's worth asking how those numbers would change if more North Carolinians really grappled with why the monuments were created and what exactly they were intended to honor. Brundage believes few people are truly aware of the statue's history. "I think most people don't know anything about the monuments," he said. "I can't tell you how many people told me that they have never really paid much attention to Silent Sam on the UNC campus until the dedication speech was published. And then they were like, 'Oh my God, that monument has got to go.'" The next article is a pictorial one we'll try to describe for you. It's entitled, "Why We March." 10,000 people amassed in downtown Raleigh Saturday to demand change. This is what we saw. Saturday morning dawned in downtown Raleigh with biting cold and the sound of shrill whistles as some 10,000 protesters bundled up against the wind, crowded together on the 400 block of Fayetteville Street, holding tightly colored signs that declared, "Fear has no place in school," and "We deserve better." The crowd waited to begin its advance from City Plaza to Halifax Mall, the scheduled site for the rally to follow the Raleigh March for Our Lives. A few hours later, several thousand more demonstrators would gather at CCB Plaza in Durham. Following the mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, that claimed 17 lives on Valentine's Day, Saturday's protest was one of many that took place across the world, including a massive rally in Washington, D.C. that drew upward of 800,000 people. Led by its two high school student organizers, Amber Mitchell and Lauren Smith, the Raleigh March wound through nearly a mile downtown with protesters chanting condemnation of gun violence, the NRA, the spineless lawmakers who do the bidding of their gun lobby masters. "Hey there, Richard Burr and Tom Tillis," editor's note. Mitchell and Smith said they were blown away, this response from the Triangle. "It's amazing," Smith said. "I never thought there would be this many people here, and I just can't believe it." And so some of the pictures. One young girl, Sophie Lynn, 14, is tired of gun violence in school. She says, "Lawmakers need to open their eyes." She's seen standing in the middle of a street, holding a sign across her that says, "I shop at Target. I don't want to be one." Organizers Lauren Smith and Amber Mitchell are 15-year-old Wake County students. "I just want people to know that things may seem big, but if one person just has a goal and gets other people involved, then we can make things happen," Mitchell says. Smith agrees. "We want legislatures to know that we're serious, and if they don't take us seriously, we will be voting very soon." They're just seen standing in a park as a part of their protest. Sarika Bomham, a 49-year-old new to Raleigh, came to show solidarity with the students who organized the rallies. "Kids are raising their voices, and they are the future. I want to show them that they are not alone, so that will motivate them in the future." Then just a crowd, with one student holding up a sign that said, "Students call, BS." The caption reads, "A Raleigh marcher holds up a sign with Parkland student Emma Gonzalez's rallying cry." Then you have a mother and daughter. 6-year-old Ava Breyer stands with her mother, Shauna, a licensed gun owner who is protesting for universal background checks and stricter gun law. The mother and daughter each have a little sign hung around their neck. The little girl says, "Please stop. Shoots. Bites." And the mother says, "Gun owner, I support gun control." And then Joan Schmidt, 80, sits with Gail Kennedy, 66. Both are former teachers. "We love kids, And hate this, Kennedy said. They're sitting there, each with a sign. One reads, arms are for hugging. The other says, enough is enough. We turn now to the indie food section. Whole hog. In a classic PB&J, or in a glaze for ham, Fogwood Farms balsamic grape hull jam is compulsively edible. As an avowed jelly junkie, I know there are many jewel-toned jars of sweetness as there are tweens at a Justin Bieber concert. There are plenty of imaginative spreads for the carb of your choosing, and even more that nobody in their right mind should ever spread on anything. It can be both confusing and intimidating. But fear not. There's actually one versatile local jam that makes the best peanut butter and jelly sandwich ever. It comes from a farm in Reeseville called Fogwood. It's grape, but Welch has never sold a grape like this. They call it balsamic grape hull jam. It contains peponius balsamic and grape hulls, as well as cinnamon, clove, salt, and pepper, and Fogwood-grown ginger. It's sold in the produce section of local Lowe's Foods and at the Bodega Urban Market. This alchemical concoction is sweet, but not crazy sweet. It's spicy, but not Scoville spicy. It's more Carmen Miranda spicy. With a stellar supporting cast, it takes a hummable PB&J right out of the lunchbox and into the realm of lunchtime legend. Goober Grape on Wonder Bread, when eaten by a responsible adult, seems less charmingly childlike than a drunk frat bro, but everyone needs a good PB&J sometimes. This elevated version is the answer. So we have our jam. Next is really good bread. Not just a vehicle to transport filling to mouth. We need a rustic loaf, hearty and handmade by a master baker like LaFarm's Liable That Net. His seasonal buckwheat is perfect. Chewy, yet tender, spicy, but slightly sweet. Then comes the PB. Big Spoons Roasters, a Durham company that won a 2017 Southern Living Food Award, is a terrific choice. They produce tons of flavors with the finest ingredients, creativity, and a wicked Bull City sense of humor. You don't even need your spread to be solely of the peanut variety, dealer's choice, but the peanut pecan is pretty darn dreamy, just saying. But Fogwood's balsamic grape hull jam is more versatile than that. If you feel like rolling up your sleeves, well, every holiday, I make a big ham for our family. It's a culinary centerpiece. I've made hundreds of them, which means I have some thoughts for preparing and flavoring what should be a bona fide porcine stopover. Chinese five-spice powder should be a legally mandated part of every ham glaze. The Zippy seasoning is made of cinnamon, cloves, fennel seeds, star anise, and Szechuan peppercorns. It's ubiquitous in Chinese cuisine, but also pairs perfectly with the salty complexity of ham. The spices in the jam share many of the same notes, and it makes it the perfect sweet element in glaze. The jam also makes an easy dressing that works on almost any salad. Just throw a quarter cup of apple cider vinegar, a tablespoon each of Dijon and Fogwood jam, salt and pepper, and a shallot into a blender. While blending, slowly drizzle in 3/4 of a cup of olive oil. Check for seasoning and use immediately. Even just a tablespoon of two stirred into food imparts a lightly sweet, complex depth of flavor. It superbly enhances dishes like chili, slow-cooked spaghetti sauce, gumbos, and even Brunswick stew. Fogwood's balsamic grape hull jam is gloriously versatile. It's delicious by itself, but also works and plays well with others. And now from the indie music section, Theory and Practice. As a writer and as a DJ, Rupture, Jace Clayton, has been both prophet and architect of our digital global past genre musical age. They are resonant objects vibrating at similar frequencies, Jace Clayton says of the seemingly disparate events in his Soundside Echo series unfolding next week in Durham and Chapel Hill. The New York City-based musician and writer is currently UNCCH Duke Nonoral Kayomi Distinguished Visiting Professor, a position usually reserved for a research scientist. Clayton is as close to being one as a DJ can get. As DJ Rupture, he was a pioneer of the early internet era of musical deracination, employing his ideas on the sea-changing digital mixtape Gold Teeth Thief in 2001. By the time 2008's Uproot, a visionary collage of global bass music, came out, it sounded like a distant but inevitable future. Now that we're used to music thinking like some giant collective brain, it just sounds like now. More than merely a musical trailblazer, Clayton has bent his practice toward re-imaging the local in a global culture and lifting up the voices it leaves out. Among other topics, we spoke with him about how this thread connects his work with cumbia, Indian classical, and neglected minimalist composer Julius Eastman. The Indie asks the question, how do these diverse events come out of your core interests? He answered, my biggest statement is my book, Uproot, Travels in the 21st Century Music and Digital Culture. We are living in a really dramatic shift from primarily analog ways of making music and communicating and remembering things to a primarily digital one. And it happened really fast. I was working as a DJ throughout this sea change, so I'm interested in critical intimacy, writing as an artist and critic, but also in this new set of tools, how music is evolving and moving around. I'm also thinking about expanded ideas of American identity, discovering the Indian community in Kerry was like, wow, this transforms my understanding of what the triangle is. It was the same thing with cumbia when I was living in a Mexican neighborhood in Brooklyn and discovered this massive cultural movement completely off the radar of mainstream media. There's a culture of shadow around cumbia about recognizing those who can't be in the place, those back in Mexico. This is using music as a transnational media system to redefine our idea of local and how technology shapes it. How voices who don't have the traditional means of amplification can communicate in culture is the through line, even with Julius Eastman. In 2001, I discovered this black gay New Yorker who died in 1990 at age 49. He knew John Cage and Morton Feldman. He worked with Arthur Russell. He sang with Meredith Monk. Yet he was almost completely written out of the historical record. His music is stunning, and I thought it was a travesty that I had never heard of him. I knew I needed to do a project engaging with what this radical figure was, who people knew about him, and what he was going to change, and how it was going to change our understanding of what minimalism was, what the classical world in New York City looked like in the 70s and in the 80s. The Indie went on, and we've seen critics take up that argument. With 2001's Gold Teeth Thief, you were also at the forefront of the digitalization and globalization of music, which happened so fast. Can you remember what you thought was going to happen and compare it to how those tools and what culture actually evolved? He answered, I made it, burned it on a CD, sent it to a friend in America. Clayton was living abroad at the time, and it was like, can you pat this on a website, an MP3, so people can download it? I had no idea people would listen to it. I felt like what I was doing was groundbreaking and amazing, but this was deeply unconfirmed. He laughs. It really blew people's minds, and they went out and found every record on the track list. Listening habits being so magpie and singles-based and picky-choosy and post-genre now, that's a really new development. It took a lot of active going against the grain in the late 90s. Yes, I listened to rap and country, etc. In today's terms, you'd say it went viral. Wire wrote about it, and Rolling Stone ended up reviewing it. That eagerness for new sounds, new ways of combining sounds and creating narratives blew me away. This was all part and parcel of the early blogosphere, the way before YouTube and social media. It was a peer-to-peer situation where corporate giants and weird advertising hadn't fully kicked in yet. An incredible moment for music sharing and discovery across the web. Now in the middle of this whole Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal, so much of the promise of grassroots empowerment, we see how quickly that environment can be twisted to corporate and political ends. And a last question. We have a lot of ways of using sound. Did you ever consider going all in as a scholar or a pitchfork darling or an art world figure? Or do you need this multiplicity of forms to express your ideas? It seems that an album release and promotion cycle wouldn't allow enough thinking about you. He answered, I do believe in the multiplicity of forms. Some of my work as an artist is making space for those projects to exist, making connections and creating the context. Working in a more straightforward institutional framework has a stability I'm probably envious of, but there's a very specific expectation you have in many of those roles. As a DJ, it's free and amazing, and any interest in your work is a godsend. But then, it's publicist and touring mechanisms, and your work getting instrumental in various ways. In one way, it's wonderful to engage with that, but ultimately, I find a lot of it to be too far from why I got interested in music in the first place. There's an Inset article here. It's called Music Brief, Julius Eastman, a Primer. Julius Eastman was a proud, openly gay black composer and performer, active from the late 60s through his mid-80s. His massive voice could be heard on his Grammy-winning performances of Peter Maxwell Davies' 8 Songs for a Mad King, as a member of the Meredith Monk Ensemble and the SEM Ensemble, as well as booming across the dance floor with Arthur Russell. His performance of John Cage's Songbooks in 1975 was so sexually provocative, it led the composer to declare his regret at composing the piece. By the mid-80s, however, Eastman's career was in shambles from drug and alcohol abuse. Eastman was evicted from his apartment with all his possessions and compositions left behind, and Eastman walked away from his life, enduring several years of on-and-off homelessness before dying anonymously in 1990. This once key member of New York's downtown scene had become so disconnected that it took 8 months for news of his death to reach the world. It is only through the works of scholars and performers like Mary Jane Leach and ACME that Eastman's music is being resurrected from a long-forgotten past. Eastman's compositions are deeply beautiful and fiercely moving. His music is endlessly restless, expanding from tiny seeds into strong forests of sound, stretching into moments of pure ecstatic awakening. Eastman never shied away from who he was, embedding himself deeply into his own work. The role of provocateur is one he clearly relished and one reflected in his choice of titles like Evil Nigger and Gay Gorilla, both of whom are being performed by Jace Clayton, Emily Manzano, and David Friend as part of the Julius Eastman Memorial Dinner. Since 2013, Memorial Dinner for live electronics and two pianos has been performed around the world and continues to evolve. In Durham, that evolution continues with an April 4th performance at The Fruit. The two Eastman works are interspersed with original material, recasting Eastman's work for an alternative future. We turn now to the indie stage section, Masculinity Revised. In Unbecoming Ailey, Daniel B. Coleman Chavez unlearns an oppressive past in dance and reconstructs it as an empowered trans person. At age 30, transgender performance artist Daniel B. Coleman Chavez is still working through injuries sustained during the rigorous, even punishing training he underwent in childhood and adolescence as a female ballet student. In that time, Chavez, who is now a professor of women's and gender studies at UNC Greensboro, acquired a professional dancer's body and performed major repertory works. But he was also internalizing ballet's disparagement of the black female body. Warned at puberty about quickly developing gluteus calves and thick muscles, Chavez tried to starve them off, begging his parents to have the bones of his feet cracked in a reset to look like those of a white ballet dancer. There was so much about my female form my teachers wanted to erase the strength from so that I would be smaller, Chavez recalls. He couldn't truly begin to embrace blackness in performance until Venezuelan choreographer Gonzalo Espinoza, in a work entitled Presa, meaning prey, first unleashed what Chavez now terms the wild. It was one of his first experiences with modern dance. That and subsequent experiences gradually revealed the strength of his erotic power. His gender and racial dynamics were not feminine. A realization would ultimately compel him to leave dance despite being accepted for a summer position at the prestigious Alvin Ailey School in New York. That decision haunted Chavez for years to follow, but the insight also launched his journey across the continuums of race and gender. Married and divorced at 22, Chavez came into queerness first as a soft bush lesbian and then as a non-binary transmasculine person, one who chooses both male and female personal pronouns, he, they. He does not identify as a man. Chavez began to explore the contested borders of ethnicity and gender as a member of Guillermo Gomez Peña's performance art troupe, La Pocha Nostra, in San Francisco. Still in coming to terms with the intersections of transmasculinity and blackness, Chavez ultimately discovered he needed dance. Unbecoming Ali, showing in UNC's Process series this week, covers the last half of Chavez's efforts to unite these elements in a multimedia performance piece involving photography, video, movement, and poetry. There's so much about blackness, black people, black bodies that get ungendered by our history in this country and others, Chavez says. Now I come as a more masculine presenting person in a performance space. But there are still so many female forms present inside and outside me. Strength for me is not gendered because it's constantly interfacing with my blackness. So the gender gets multiplied, and that's what I want. Feminism remains a fundamental part of the multiplicity for Chavez. I don't exist without feminism, he says. As I started to transition, I realized how much I needed the feminist community to feel like a whole person. Spending time in a large trans feminist community in Barcelona, Chavez resolved that trans people need to be present in the feminist community, and that transmasculinity presents a golden opportunity to rewrite masculinity as we know it. Not so long ago, I was a lesbian woman, he says, acknowledging that many of his relationships are still with lesbian and queer women. That is my community. Never would I embody a masculinity that would distance me from them. As for the last 6 months, Chavez's physical transformation has mostly involved strength building and stretching, activating the muscles and body parts he once feared would disclose his blackness on stage. That's changed, to say the least. With a stronger body than ever, queerness and movement are both helping Chavez come into his blackness as never before. Predicated against the hypervisibility he has felt in ballet and as a transgender person, Chavez says he has been rehearsing in a space without mirrors. I'm not trying to get my body to look like any certain aesthetic, masculine enough or this or that enough, he said. The choreography I'm working on is very much about, does my body fit? Instead, Chavez's work is invested in what my body can do and what it feels like over the visual. He knows that audiences will still recognize a highly trained body in his performance. That's fine, he says. I have a lust and love for the virtuosity of the trained dancing body. He pauses, then laughs. I just want that without all the rest of it. His two public showings are slated to coincide with the Transgender Day of Visibility, which Chavez later realized was problematic. Visibility is not the answer for the communities he navigates and studies, Chavez says. We are already hyper-visible in public space. When trans people walk around, you're constantly getting clocked as a trans. It's part of the problem, and it engenders us. What's needed instead, Chavez said, is the creation of social space where transness is viewed as normal. Unbecoming Ailey is a chance to convey being a trans body from a space of joy, eroticism, and the pleasure of moving in space, and to invite others to do the same. After all, everyone, not just trans people, lives in a modified body. From the second we're born and have food put in us, from our first haircut, lotion product, or anything in us, we're not coming from a natural source, we're modified, he said. We're always transitioning. And now from the indie page, The Soft Apocalypse. Alexis Pauline Gum's groundbreaking poetic trilogy, engaging with black feminist scholars, continue in M-Archive, After the End of the World. M-Archive, After the End of the World, Duke University Press, is the second book in Durham-based poet, activist, and queer black troublemaker Alexis Pauline Gumba's groundbreaking poetic trilogy, engaging with the work of black feminist scholars. It communes with M. Jackie Alexander, the way 2016 Spill did with Hortense Spillers, and the forthcoming Dub will with Sylvia Winter. As a black feminist researcher and speculative documentarian, Gums creates an archive of the aftermath of worlds. But the darkness of the invisible is not something to be feared. Rather, Gums imaginatively investigates the bottoms of oceans, the outer linings of horizons, the sonics of breathing, and the soft underground intimations blossoming within, alongside, and ahead of us even in the midst of apocalyptic destruction. Gums invite us into the collective practice of preparing for a future where we survive by returning to and becoming accountable to the deepest parts of ourselves. Indy's question. M-Archive is so hard to describe in terms of genre. It feels like part of theoretical intervention, part historic revision, part fantasy novel, part allegory, part eco-poetics. Can you tell me a little about the hopes, intentions, and obsessions that led to M-Archive? She answers, it's being marketed as poetry, black feminist theory, and science fiction. And I don't know of any other book that had been marketed in that way. Those are all accountabilities and traditions that are important to me. It's my obsession with citing black women and my daily practice of allowing myself to go where that work takes me in a way that I am a fugitive from having to explain the work of black feminists or seeking to use it as a project that colonizes it. There are so many dynamics that work in black feminism. We deserve a depth of engagement that resists ownership, resists slavery, resists capitalism. The next question. M. Archive is deeply in dialogue with M. Jacques Alexander's Pedagogies of Crossing, Meditations on Feminism, Sexual Politics, Memory, and the Sacred. You write in the opening pages of M. Archive that Alexander's book is ancestrally co-written. How does engaging a co-written text change how you enter it? In the writing process itself, I enter through Jacques every day. The first thing I did was just rereading the text and pulling out phrases. Those images and questions became a lens for my daily life. What I realized in this process is that I enter as someone who identifies as a researcher at the end of the world. I am a black feminist researcher researching these publications that do not exist anymore. People who have died. And here I am after the end of the world and in relation to the worlds they created. Indy, you write that the form you use for M. Archive is one of speculative documentary. Why do you feel drawn to write about the speculative? In Durham, the coalition of black documentarians was starting to coalesce, led by Michelle Lanier, and at one of these meetings, the go-around question was, what documentary work are you currently working on? I realized, oh, this is documentary work, but speculative documentary work. It's not evidence of what has happened, but it is a possible interpretation of the evidence we are now making. It might be different now than taking a camera and interviewing someone, but it is co-written with the future survivors of this moment. Question. Why was it so important for you to work through and with archives? She said, archives are really sacred spaces for me. That has been the case for a long, long time. I remember my first archival encounter, and I think I was 15. It was at the Auburn Avenue Library in Atlanta. I had the opportunity to work with the original newspapers of the Black Panthers. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder, this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.